Carla, you ready? Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the May 28th meeting of the Portland City Council. Would you please call the roll, Carla?
Fish.
Here.
Saltzman.
Here.
Novick.
Here.
Fritz.
Here.
Hales.
Here. Welcome, everybody. Let me set the stage here with some procedures that we follow in council meetings. First, the purpose of city council meetings is obviously the orderly consideration of the public's business. So courtesy and decorum are really important here in this chamber. And that's why we welcome everyone in a wide variety of points of view into the discussions that we have here. During this meeting, there will be time-limited opportunities for public comment on the agenda items that we have today. We don't have council communications this afternoon. We just have regular agenda items. If you're here to testify, please state your name for the record. We don't need your address. If you're a lobbyist representing an organization under our code, you need to disclose that information, please, at the start of your testimony. If you're here representing a nonprofit organization or an organization in the community, please disclose that as well. It's not required, but we appreciate it. Typically, on a calendar where we have a lot of people signed up, and I think we do this afternoon, we'll allow 2 minutes in individual testimony. Obviously, though, we have a land use case this afternoon, and we'll go through the particular times associated with that. Please testify only to the matter at hand. If you have handouts, please give them to the council clerk so that she can distribute them to us. We have these rules of procedure, again, to preserve the public order and the record and the right for everyone to be heard. Any conduct that disrupts that process, like shouting during the council meeting, which unfortunately we've had in a previous case, is really unacceptable because it does prevent your fellow citizens from being heard, and it can't be allowed. So please, if you want to show your support or your opposition to one of your fellow citizens' points of view, feel free to give them a thumbs up or a thumbs down. But we ask that you not make vocal demonstrations in favor or against your fellow citizens' points of view so they get to express them. And therefore, I have to express this warning that anybody that disrupts the proceedings may be escorted from the council chambers and excluded from City Hall. We did, as I mentioned, have a disruption at a previous land use hearing, and we had to exclude a couple of people, and that's sad. Regarding today's meeting, we have a lot of people signed up here today. We have an overflow room in the Portland building for those that aren't able to fit into the council chambers. We'll go through the process here of what is involved in a contested case land use hearing in terms of the times of presentation, and then we'll have the clerk call people up to testify. She'll read 3 names in order to come up to the table, and then names from the next group so that people can be on deck. So if you're in the Portland building in the overflow room and you hear your name called, please come on over, and that way you'll be here on deck ready to testify when the group that's already up is done. Let's see. Again, because of the number of people that we have signed up, I think 2 minutes apiece. We sometimes allow 3, but I think in order to have everybody get heard, we're going to go with 2 minutes for testimony. There's a clock that in front of us that at 90 seconds, you'll hear a beep and a light. That indicates you've got 30 seconds left. At 2 minutes, you'll hear 4 beeps and the lights will flash. And that's so that the next person can speak. So please close at that point. At 6 p.m., I'm planning to close the hearing because council members have other business. So I think we can get through it all by then. Unless council states otherwise, at the end of the hearing, if we're unable to hear testimony today from everyone who signs up and wishes to speak, we'll continue to accept written testimony for the next 2 weeks, which is our typical practice, and then reconvene at a later date for appellant's rebuttal statements and deliberations. We'll make an announcement at the end of the hearing about times and dates for accepting written testimony and council deliberation if we do follow that process. So just to be clear, today's the day for oral testimony. We'll again take additional written testimony if we're not able to hear from everybody in person. I think that's the procedure that I need to go through, so why don't you read the item, and then we'll ask the city attorney to go through the land use process, and I'll need to ask about ex parte contacts and conflicts of interest.
Item 547, appeal of Portland Water Bureau and Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association against Historic Landmarks Commission's decision to approve with conditions a proposal to disconnect the Mount Tabor reservoirs from the public drinking water system at Mount Tabor Park, located at 6325 Southeast Division Street, LU14218444HREN.
Great, thank you. So maybe I should start with that declaration. This is a contested case land use hearing, and under state law, we're required to disclose if we have had any ex parte communications, meaning outside of this formal state prescribed process, or if we have any conflicts of interest. Anyone have anything to state?
Mayor, my office has received lots of emails and phone calls and visits, and we've screened the commissioner in charge the way we do on all contested land use hearings.
Okay. Anything else?
I got a couple of emails. I don't know if she's actually a party, but a couple of emails from Floyd Jones that came to my personal emails. I forwarded them to my work account, did not review them in any detail whatsoever.
Okay. Anything else? Anyone have any questions about those declarations? If not, then I'll turn it over to the city attorney to walk us through the process.
Can I just raise a point of order?
Sure.
Because this is an important topic for the community, I just wonder, I don't know that we're on TV.
Well, I think we are. We will be.
I think they're having some technical difficulties. I'm working on it.
All right. We should be on TV, as we usually are, but we're not yet. Okay. Hopefully we're on audio anyway.
That's actually a good question. Carla, do we know if the audio is being recorded?
Yes, I'm recording.
Okay. Thank you.
That's good.
Are you ready?
Yes, please.
Okay. So the city attorney begins with some announcements that help us conform with state law, and they describe the way the hearing will be held today. This is going to be an evidentiary hearing, which means you may submit new evidence to the council in support of your arguments. I'm going to talk first about the order of testimony today. We're going to begin with a staff report for about 10 minutes from the Bureau of Development Services. And then we're going to follow in this order. And it's a little unusual. We usually don't have two appellants. So we're starting with appellant number one, which is the Water Bureau. They'll have 10 minutes to make their initial presentation, followed by the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association as the second appellant, who will have 10 minutes. We will then have public testimony, which the mayor has announced at 2 minutes each. And then we'll have the appellant one, Portland Water Bureau's response for 10 minutes, appellant two, the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association's response for 10 minutes. If we get through all of that, then we would then have rebuttal from both of the appellants, again in the same order, appellant one, Water Bureau, followed by appellant two, the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association. They will each have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Following that, there will be council discussion. So I'm going to announce some guidelines for those of you who will be addressing council today. First, submitting evidence into the record. Any letters or documents you wish to become part of this record must be given to the council clerk after you testify. The original or a copy of any slides, photographs, drawings, maps, videos, or other items you show to council during your testimony, including your PowerPoint presentations, must be given to the council clerk to ensure they're part of the record. Second, the testimony must be directed to the approval criteria for this review. Any testimony, arguments, and evidence you present must be directed toward the applicable approval criteria or other criteria in the city's plan or zoning code you believe apply to the decision. BDS staff will identify the applicable approval criteria as part of their initial staff report. Finally, issues must be raised with specificity. You must raise an issue clearly enough to give the council and the other parties an opportunity to respond to the issue. If you don't, you will be precluded from appealing to the Land Use Board of Appeals based on that issue.
So I've got a question, Lindley, because this is kind of an unusual proceeding for us to have double appeals. You know, we often have appeals of a land use decision by someone, whether it's a neighborhood or an applicant. So we have a section, as we always do, for public testimony. Do people have to sign up on one side or the other, or have we?
Because we have appellants on both sides, we've simply, in the notice that we provided, we just said public testimony.
Okay.
So I don't think we need to do it that way. Can I confirm one thing? Because this is slightly, what I got out of this is a little different. I want to confirm with staff that the appellant one and appellant two responses are after public testimony, or are they intended to be before?
I just want to make sure. Initial presentation, you mean?
No, their initial presentation is before testimony.
Yeah.
I just want to make sure that their
responses.
I know they have a rebuttal period at the very end, but we have something called their response. Was that intended to be before or after testimony? After? That's what I thought. So I'm looking at this, and I'm actually, I'd like to clarify
that order.
Because
okay.
It's different than what I thought as I was reading from the sheet. My understanding was that both, as we would if there were only one appellant, you have the opportunity to make your initial presentation, and then the other party would have a chance to respond to that. So we're actually going to go 10 minutes Water Bureau, 10 minutes Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association, then 10 minutes for the Water Bureau to respond to what they heard from the Neighborhood Association, and 10 minutes for the Neighborhood Association to respond to what they heard from the Water Bureau.
Okay.
At that point, public testimony.
Then we go to public testimony.
I apologize for the confusion.
No, that's all right, because I think this is the first one, at least that I've seen lately, that we've had dueling appeals, if you will. So.
Me too.
Yeah, all right. Good. Other questions before we start the process? So, again, people have signed up, and I'll just take people in order as they are on the list rather than worrying about which side of the appeal people are signed up on, right? Because, again, that's a little different.
Usually we have people arguing in favor of the appellant.
We have support and oppose. Just appeal. No specific which
appeal
you
support. You have a sign-up sheet of supporters and a sign-up sheet of people who oppose the decision, right? Okay.
We just put as the oppose the appeal.
Which could mean
I don't have the sign-up sheets up here, so
bear
I'm
with us,
exactly
folks.
Sure
this is a little bit uncharted territory for us, so our apologies. But it's normal that we would have a single appellant, and somebody would either be supporting or opposing the appellant. In this case, we have two appellants with different arguments. So my suggestion is that we probably just take that list as a committee of the whole. And we'll let people let us know where they are and give the council the opportunity to keep it straight rather than trying to resort the list.
Right, because there's only the one.
So, yeah, and I think one of the lists appeared at least a long time ago to be quite a bit shorter. So if you wanted to alternate, that would be fine, too.
We're only two on it. So.
Okay.
I'm sorry?
There were only two on the other, which I thought said oppose or support the appeal, rather.
Okay.
Where the longer list just says to.
I think if you've got more than 40 people signed up on the other list, right? I would say let's just take both lists together. Again, there may be people. Well, let me ask. This is a decision of the Historic Landmarks Commission, right? It's been appealed by two different parties. Are there folks here who are here in support of the decision of the Landmarks Commission? If there's one. Okay. All right. So,
Mayor,
they are opponents of the appeal. Sorry.
I think there's some confusion, Mayor.
Yeah, I'm confused too.
I think it's also a de novo hearing.
Yeah.
So technically, people can speak to any issue.
If it's
they
a
want.
De novo hearing, we should take them as a committee of the whole.
I think we should take them as many as.
That's right.
Yep.
All right. So,
Mayor,
folks, we'll take you in batting order and let you tell us which side of the case that you're on.
We'll try to keep it all clear. Mayor, I just want to go back to the audio-video issue. We may have one or more PowerPoints, and right now I don't know whether that system is working. What happened?
Hey, there we go. It's working.
Nice work, Carla.
Yeah, so we will be able to show the PowerPoints in council. At my understanding, the recording guy had trouble getting to City Hall. So.
All right.
So anyway,
one more question. Do we have people in overflow, and are they at least able to hear the audio so that they would know to come over?
Are there people overflow?
We just need to make sure that if there are people who want to testify, they can come.
We don't know if they've got audio over there or not.
I think we ought to wait a second.
So the technical guy, the audio guy, or the video guy is there now, so we should get video up in any moment.
I just will note the mayor has put some money in his budget for a technology upgrade.
Yeah, no kidding.
So
now we know why.
Yes, we have people in the overflow.
All right. And they have, they're connected. Okay.
Good job.
All right. So let us begin with a staff report. That part, at least, is conventional.
Commissioners, Mayor, Hillary Adam, BDS, thank you. So this is the appeal of a Type 3 Historic Resource Review and Type 2 Environmental Review, LU 14218444-HREN, the Mount Tabor Reservoir's disconnection. This is just a quick zoning overview. The site is Mount Tabor Park. It's zoned OS, which is open space with environmental conservation overlay in portions. It's the Mount Tabor Park Historic District and the Mount Tabor Reservoir's Historic District. The entire Mount Tabor Park is a historic district. The approval criteria are the are 33.846060G other approval criteria, as well as 33.430250A for the portions in the environmental zones. This is just an aerial view of Mount Tabor Park, and you can see the reservoirs there, with 6 to the west for the moving east, reservoir 5, and then reservoir 1 a little bit to the south. So the summary, and this is distilled a little bit, just because there are a bunch of different factors, but to simplify it, I highlighted some of the major points. The Portland Water Bureau is proposing to cap and plug existing underground pipe in order to disconnect the reservoirs from the drinking water system. That would include removing some existing trees and then landscaping and restoration of that landscaping, removal of existing underground vaults and construction of new underground vaults, construction of above-ground electrical cabinets on concrete pads, and screening inlet wear openings and pipe openings, removing pipe ends and installing caps on the flanges of the outlet pipes, and minor alterations at Gatehouse 6 East. The Historic Landmarks Commission, we met for 4 hearings, and they ultimately decided 7-0 to approve the proposal with conditions, and I've included all of those conditions here. A is a standard condition that we apply to all land use cases. B, I've highlighted in red portions of the conditions that are contested or up for discussion. I'll just read this aloud. Following completion of the disconnection, reservoirs 1, 5, and 6 must continue to hold water within the normal historic operating range for each reservoir, which is 50 to 75%. The reservoirs must be maintained and clean and may be empty partially or fully for brief periods as necessary to address system operational requirements to maintain security, regulatory compliance, or for safety concerns. The reservoirs shall not be partially or fully emptied for more than 60 days total, either consecutive or non-consecutive, within a calendar year, except in emergency circumstances. Any proposal to permanently remove visible water from the site as required in the preceding sentence will require a follow-up land use application to be reviewed by the Historic Landmarks Commission. I noted the 50 to 75% because this is potentially an error on my part where the Water Bureau noted that the historic fill levels were 50 to 75% during one hearing and then later said that they were 65 to 85%. So when we were drafting this condition, my recollection recalled 50 to 75%. But the latest, at that time, the latest value was 65 to 85%. So I just wanted to clarify that point. So
your recommendation would be to amend that condition to say 75
yes.
to 85?
Right.
65 to 85?
Yeah. Also, partially or fully emptied for more than 60 days total, the Water Bureau has contested this whole sentence, actually, and they will speak to that. Continuing, condition C was about an interpretation program to basically tell the story of the Mount Tabor Reservoir system, including the disconnection, so that people going there would know that they're know their history and also that they no longer contain drinking water, just to be honest about what they would be after the disconnection. D is about archaeology. This is sort of a standard type of condition where there's extensive digging involved. Condition E is the Water Bureau appealed based on this condition, and also Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association has some points to make about this. I'll just read it. The City of Portland shall formally adopt the May 2009 Mount Tabor Reservoir's Historic Structures Report and fully implement the short and long-term restorative recommendations and maintenance therein, including removal of non-historic elements such as light fixtures and conduit and restoration of the contributing resources of the Mount Tabor Park Reservoir's Historic District by December 31st, 2019. This condition specifically was This was created during the fourth hearing, and I believe that it's a major point for that helped a lot of the historic landmarks commissioners get over the hump so that they could approve the proposal. They felt that there needs to be a long-term preservation plan at Mount Tabor for the reservoirs, and so this condition was imposed. And we do have three of those commissioners here to testify. Okay. So if you'd like to call them up after or during public testimony. These are the conditions that were applied to the environmental review portion of the decision. As far as I know, there are not any major concerns with these. So I included them just to be complete. So appellant one, their reasons for appeal was the statement in condition B, the reservoirs shall not be partially or fully emptied for more than 60 days total, either consecutive or non-consecutive within a calendar year, except in emergency circumstances. The Water Bureau contends that this aspect is mathematically impossible to meet, and I will let them address that their concerns with that. But I just wanted to point out that the Landmarks Commission, their primary concern was that the water level in the reservoirs would be maintained at historic levels, sort of that iconic postcard view. That was also important for the State Historic Preservation Office. They made a point of saying that they found no adverse effect as long as there was water kept in the reservoirs at their historic levels. Condition E, the Water Bureau is appealing that entire condition. They say that they do not have the budget to implement all of those restoration components. And again, as I said, the Landmarks Commission, their primary concern was to ensure the long-term preservation of these historic resources. Appellant two, Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association. These were the reasons for the appeal listed in the initial appeal application. One, BDS failed to require identification of legal lot boundaries to demonstrate the applicant has the authority over the subject property. To that, I just provided simple responses. The property is owned by the city, and the Water Bureau is acting as an agent of the city, and Parks has agreed to work with the Water Bureau as part of this proposal. Two, the proposal changes the amount of existing basic utility use by more than 10%, therefore conditional use is required. Section 33815040A, BDS does not believe that that applies because the proposal is not for a new conditional use, a change to another use in another category, adding another use, or changing any specifically approved amount of the existing conditional use. Number three, the exterior improvement area exceeds 1,500 square feet, therefore conditional use is required. The exterior improvement area does not exceed 1,500 square feet, and the record shows a net loss of exterior improvement area. Four, the record lacks sufficient evidence demonstrating that the applicant retain and preserve the reservoirs, therefore approval criterion number one is not met. And condition B requires the reservoirs be filled with water at their historic levels in order to ensure that approval criterion number one is met. And the approval criterion does not require that the water be potable. Number five, the project jeopardizes the existing conditional use status and does not ensure possible future restoration of the historic function of the site. Therefore, approval criteria number two and number nine are not met. The conditional use status of the site is not jeopardized by the disconnection, as this status is not changing. While not specifically required by the approval criteria, the disconnection is designed to be reversible in response to public comments. Approval criteria number nine are met with the conditions attached to each. Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association provided additional requests. I'm just going to list them here. I'm going to need a bit more time.
Yes, that's fine. We typically grant staff more time on a complicated staff report. Go ahead.
And then I'm sure that they will elaborate. I just wanted to highlight them. One, deny the applicant's challenge to the clause in Condition B that protects constancy of the iconic views. Two, deny the applicant's challenge to Condition E. Instead, respect the Historic Landmarks Commission mandate for historic preservation work at the historic Mount Tabor Reservoir site. Three, correct the Scrivener's error in condition B, strike the incorrect 50 to 75% reference supplied by BDS staff during the Landmarks Commission deliberations and replace it with 65% to 85%, which is the range set forth by applicant testimony, Exhibit H51. 4, clarify the language of Condition B, revise the current text, the normal historic operating range, to read the normal historic operation range, producing iconic views. 5, limit the timeline of Condition E's preservation work so as to be concurrent with the timeline of other project construction. As such, we ask Council to shorten the completion deadline for the preservation work to May 2017. 6, strengthen the Landmarks Commission's efforts to protect Tabor's historic assets. We ask you to require the applicant to, within 1 year, craft a written long-range preservation plan, including at least 5 years of budget projections in concert with SHPO and under design advice review with Historic Landmarks Commission to be formally adopted before Council. And 7, direct the applicant to 1, file for conditional use review before proceeding further, and 2, develop a plan to protect the site's existing conditional use status, which is basic utility. And so you have two options today. One is to adopt the Historic Landmarks Commission's decision of approval with conditions, thus denying the appeals that would be accepting it as it is written. And 2, modify the Historic Landmarks Commission's decision of approval with conditions by revising, adding, or eliminating conditions, thus accepting part or all of either appellant's appeals. And that is it.
Okay. Questions?
Isn't a third option to deny the application?
That is a possibility. Neither of the appellants is requesting that. Okay. So that is why I left it off.
Thank you. And then I have a clarification, and I don't know whether you can answer this or maybe the Historic Landmarks Commissioners can, regarding the condition of approval about the Historic Structures Report.
Uh-huh.
It's contested. So on page 19 of the Hearings Officer's decision addressing approval criterion for historic features, there's a discussion that there was going to be a proposal to repair the Reservoir 1 parapet, and that was withdrawn. And it says the commission notes that it's most certainly in need of repair, encourages the Water Bureau to present a proposal for repair of the parapet wall, and then no deteriorated features are proposed to be replaced, and therefore this criterion is not applicable. But then turning the page to page 21, there's an extensive discussion of repairs and the proposed condition of approval to require all kinds of renovations,
right,
which I've looked up the report, and there's several pages of different things which presumably would have to go through Historic Landmarks review.
Potentially. Some of repair and maintenance are exempt from historic resource review. So when this first came in, it included repair of the parapet walls at Reservoir 1, and I advised that they withdraw that portion because it did not seem like it was subject to review, and also I just didn't know if it was the right in order to move forward. I didn't feel like I had enough information at the time, but it, I felt like it was potentially exempt. And from what I heard from them at the time was that they had budgeted for those repairs, and they're still planning to do that. So, but where that is in the process, they would probably be the better ones to ask.
But that's that's the rule the rule of how we proceed with historic landmarks, right? If you're going to repair or renovate the existing historic features, you don't need to go through a landmarks review. If you're going to change the historic features or remove them, you do, right?
Yeah, right.
And has staff done any assessment of the table of repairs outlined in the structures report to see if they're all exempt?
I haven't gone through it to look at that like that, no.
Okay. And how much discussion was there at the Historic Landmarks Commission about the content of that report?
There was quite a bit. The neighbors introduced that into the record and raised concerns that a lot of those aspects had not been completed yet. The Water Bureau responded to that, and I think their concerns were about budgeting in terms of how they're moving along that path, but they have not formally adopted that report, I know.
Okay. And then I have a question for the city attorney, which I think I know the answer to. The Historic Landmarks Commission cannot direct the council to adopt something. Is that correct?
No, they can recommend.
Thank you.
Okay, other questions for Ms. Adam? Thank you very much. Okay, let's move on into the procedure as we've had it outlined, and that is we'll take appellant number one, and that's the Portland Water Bureau. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mayor Hills and Commissioners. I'm Teresa Elliott, Principal Engineer with Portland Water Bureau, and I'm in charge of the Tabor Reservoir project that's before you today. With me are Mike Sturr, David Schaff, Tom Carter, and Kristen Miner from Peter Meiser Architects.
Good afternoon, Commissioners. I'm Kristen Miner. And the Portland Water Bureau asked my office to review the proposed work as a historic consultant, using the lens of both the city's approval criteria as well as the State Historic Preservation Office, commonly called SHPO. Most of the work proposed occurs in one or both of two National Register-listed historic districts. Both were put on the National Register in 2004, and there is no other known instance of one historic district being entirely nested within another one, a very unusual circumstance. But they do have a slightly different focus. One is on the reservoir, the reservoirs, the gatehouses, and the working water system. The other is really focused on the park and its features, playgrounds, public walkways, picnic structures, etc. Because they're all alterations proposed within a historic district, the city review is a historic resource review. There's also a staff-level environmental review that was folded in. I have reviewed the documentation submitted to the SHPO, which explains the work in detail to them, and the SHPO found that the work proposed would have no adverse effects on either historic district. Hillary has noted the elements of the proposal, but just a quick run-through. I have a summary again. So the major work is to disconnect the reservoirs from the drinking water system. Secondly, to construct a buried large-diameter pipe to bypass the reservoirs. This work is primarily under existing roadways and in open lawn areas. Water will be maintained in the reservoir basins. In the photo on the left is Gatehouse 5, and you can see a new little round inlet cap appearing above the water. On the right, you can see Gatehouse 1. It has a new inlet cap as well on its side, and a new screen on the basin weir, which is that kind of horizontal dark area. Now, in these renderings, the caps were given a higher contrast just to make them easier to see. They would blend in. Historic districts may have contributing and non-contributing resources. So contributing resources date from the period of significance, which in this case is 1894 to 1953, and they're related by use and construction. Non-contributing resources were added after the period of significance and don't contribute to the historic character of the district. As an example, the photo on the lower right. The Reservoir Historic District has 12 contributing resources, which I'm listing out for you on the slide there, and then three that are called out as non-contributing. In the larger park historic district, there are many more of each. In this case, alterations to contributing resources have a very minimal visual impact. The review also considers the larger district-wide compatibility, including the character of the landscaping. Each area is generally described in the historic nomination in terms of its character and feeling, if you will. The proposal keeps the landscape character of each work area. We assessed the proposal's effects on landscaping and views and found no significant visual change. On the left is a photo of the construction that was required to bring in the fourth conduit at Reservoir 5 Weir Inlet, and I think this photo dates from approximately 1940. As the city's water usage expanded over time, so did the water supply system. The piping and buried infrastructure has been added to and altered over time at this site. Underground work is typically not reviewed by the city, as it's not, in the end, visible. On the right is the Weir Inlet at Reservoir 5, actually the same location as in this photo, which will have a screen added. It's very hard to see. It's inset and in shadow. The work proposed, even that work underground, will be reversible, meaning that the historic resources could be restored to their original condition after the work is completed. Reversibility isn't a code requirement. Proposed work should be undertaken in a manner that, if it's later removed, the historic resource would remain unimpaired, and that is the case with the proposal. As far as visual impacts, there are very limited visual impacts overall. Alterations to contributing resources are extremely minor, and the state did agree that the work did not cause any adverse effect, and therefore no mitigation was required for the historic proposal.
The Landmarks Commission proposed approved the Water Bureau's land use application with five conditions. We're only appealing two of these conditions. The Water Bureau's original proposal stated that we would fill and refresh the reservoirs, and we're committed to doing that. We're happy to meet the other conditions, too, such as the requirement to construct educational components to explain the history of the water system and the site. The Water Bureau is not appealing the entire decision. We're appealing part of the wording of Condition B and all of Condition E. First, I'll talk about Condition B. The Water Bureau asks that the sentence highlighted in red be removed and, if necessary, replaced with a sentence like what we submitted in our written testimony on May 14th. The Water Bureau uses two operating ranges. Both of them are correct. 50% to 75% and 65% to 85%. The difference is an operational issue balancing the needs upstream and downstream of the reservoirs. I'm going to walk through a couple quick slides to explain why we cannot meet the 60-day restriction in Condition B. For simplicity, I've used 50 and 85% levels to illustrate the draining, cleaning, and refilling cycle.
Could you pull your mic down just a little bit? There you go, thanks.
There is a memo in the record that explains this in more detail. Today, most of the water in the reservoirs is released into the reservoir into the distribution before we start the cycle. We drain to the sewer only about 4 million gallons, or 3% of the total volume, which takes 3 days. In the future, the full volume in the reservoirs has to be drained to the sewer as non-potable water. If it, at 50% full, it would take 45 days to drain 65.5 million gallons of water held. At 85% full, it would take 77 days to drain 111 million gallons. These calculations are based on the discharge rate of 1,000 gallons a minute, which is dictated by our permits from BES and DEQ. Once the reservoirs are drained, it takes about 14 days to clean all three reservoirs and another 7 days to start refilling them. The amount of time cleaning and refilling is not expected to change in the future. Today, the total time to drain, clean, and refill is about 24 days, not counting our disinfection time. Under the future condition, at 50% full, it would take 66 days per cycle to drain, clean, and refill all three reservoirs. At 85% full, it would take 98 days. The Water Bureau can meet Condition B, provided it's modified as requested. As long as it remains, we can only clean once a year, and even then, it will take more time than the condition allows. What is more, we also need time for the reservoirs to be empty to do any repair and maintenance. The 60-day time limit does not allow any time for that.
I'm Tom Carter with the Water Bureau, and I'm going to talk about why the Water Bureau asks that Condition E be removed entirely from the decision. Landmarks Commission's findings indicated that the proposed work will not adversely affect the historic resources, and the zoning code does not mention or require mitigation or restoration. So in its approval criteria. So condition E is not connected to a specific criterion that makes a legal connection, a legal requirement. Condition E also requires removal of all non-historic elements, and this is a working utility site. We use many of these elements, so it's not possible to remove them without crippling parts of the water system. If interpreted literally, we would be removing non-contributing elements such as our pump station, electrical and metering cabinets, vaults, and so on. There are no zoning code criteria or provisions that could require their removal, and each removal would require a new historic review for altering elements in the historic district. Condition E also uses the Historic Structures Report as a work plan, but the Water Bureau commissioned this report in 2009 to lay out options for planning future work. If the Water Bureau could do all the work listed, the total cost is estimated to be about $8 million in 2018 dollars. But Condition E requires it to be finished by 2019. Removing the non-historic elements would be very costly, and on top of that, we support maintaining and restoring the facilities as allowed. In fact, we did budget $100,000 to repair the deteriorating repair wall there on the upper left. But because no review is required for repair, it's not in your packet. So our ongoing operations do include historic maintenance and repairs and have been guided by the Historic Structures Report.
Yeah, I'm going to allow you another minute, but I'll do the same for the other appellant.
Thank you. And much of this work requires special skills and contractors. One major project is shown in this slide. It was the restoration of the Gatehouse 1 facade. We did receive a grant for a small portion of the work, and it ultimately cost a bit over $200,000. We are stewards of these historic resources and as well as the water system, and we must simultaneously balance costs of maintenance and restoration, water system needs, and the needs of the city as a whole. So these decisions are recommended by the Bureau, but we believe they're properly made by City Council through the citywide budget process, not through a land use review decision. In summary, then, we ask for Condition B to be modified as we have written in our letter to you of May 14th, and for Condition E to be deleted from the decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? I have one, and that is the cycle that you described of filling, draining, cleaning, and refilling, and the 1,000 gallons a minute that you would drain the reservoir at that rate. You said that's a permit requirement. That's not a physical restriction. Could you drain the reservoir faster if the permit required that, or is that a size of plumbing?
Actually, it's both. It's a permit requirement from both BES and DEQ, and they give us an operating range between 1,000 and 1,500 gallons per minute during dry weather. It is designed based on their system to make sure that we are not overwhelming their system and causing a combined sewer overflow to the river and then getting citywide violation and fines.
Right, but, so it's again, both. My question is, what are the physical limitations?
The physical limitations are the pipe diameter that it's right. going through.
And that's physical limitation is how many gallons per minute?
That basically is that 1,000 to 1,500 gallons per minute.
Couldn't do it faster if there were no regulatory issues?
No.
Okay. All right. Because I would think there might be a way to solve that problem.
Not without laying a new sewer line.
Right. If the sewer line is the size that it is, I get that. But if it's a paperwork issue, you know, that might be modifiable. Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you. Obviously, have you back later for response. Okay. Let's call the other appellant, the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association. Give you 11 minutes. For your presentation. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. Very nice to be here. Ty Wyman, as attorney for Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association. I'm joined at the table today by Stephanie Stewart, who is the chair of the Land Use Committee at MTNA. She's a 16-year resident of the Mount Tabor neighborhood, has been actively engaged in the reservoir issue for 7 years. To my far right is John Larson, a 15-year board member at MTNA, 33-year neighborhood resident. And he wouldn't give me the number of years that he's been actively involved in the reservoir issue. He just said many. Commissioner Fish called this a de novo hearing, and at some level it is because you're taking evidence. But It's not de novo in the sense that you do have a big record that has been given to you. A big record, a complete record, one that went through, was it three, was it four hearings, and lots of written testimony. When I'm given a case like this, I encourage my client to put in writing well ahead of the hearing what their basic points are. We have done that. They submitted, Stephanie and John submitted something about a month ago. And given that, we view ourselves as here today primarily for your questions. Again, you're given a big pile of paper, asked to make a decision out of it. We've already seen how confusing it is just procedurally. So please fire away with your questions. We want to hear them. As for my involvement in this, I was brought into it only about a year ago, strictly as a land use lawyer to help the neighbors make sense of or understand better the land use process. My job over the last 20 years pretty much has been to review, understand, and apply land use codes, and I have heard a great deal of frustration, as I'm sure some of you have over those years, with codes, and the codes are full of this minutia, and what is it? Where does this minutia come from? What does it mean, and why does it exist? And I say to pretty much all of them, well, all of those code provisions are at the end of a strand that leads all the way back to the 19 statewide land use planning goals. Those set the policy. The code implements the policy. And as you can probably tell, I want to emphasize to you what your code says. Because your code is very thick, and I don't want it to get lost. I also want to contrast a little bit on some issues. State law is very, on some land use issues, state law is quite prescriptive, frankly, and tells cities this is how you will regulate development. Certainly, Goal 3 on farmland is that way. Goal 5 on natural and historic resources is less prescriptive. It really lets cities decide for themselves how they want to go about protecting them. A suburban city, Tiger, just as an example, I looked at their code, and their code allows alteration of an historic structure based on, quote, the reasonableness of the proposed alteration and its relationship to the public interest in the structure's preservation. Well, that's kind of, it's one that we lawyers tend to love. It's a little bit of a balancing calls upon a balancing of interests. Well, the Water Bureau did not stress to you, did not clarify for you the what we're calling approval standard number one under your historic preservation code. It says simply, quote, the historic character of the property will be retained and preserved. There's no balancing required. It is an absolute requirement. Furthermore, the word preserve is in my mind, in my experience, a very strong word. I went to Merriam-Webster, and its definition of preserve is to keep in its original state or in good condition. And, of course, this is going to lead into the factual testimony that I'm sure you're going to hear plenty of. If you've read the record, you've seen plenty of. These resources have not been kept in anything close to original state or good condition. They have to be, your code requires them through this process to be preserved as such. Preserve also means to keep something safe from harm or loss and to prevent something from decaying. That is the cornerstone obligation. It's not the only one, but that is the cornerstone obligation that is on this applicant, the Water Bureau. I want to make one other perspective about this process because, again, you go to most other cities, an historic preservation process is going to be heard by a lay body. It's probably going to be heard by a planning commission, maybe a hearings officer. Not here. You have empaneled a group and given them very specific jurisdiction over historic resources, and I believe that the group even is not a lay body, but they are folks with demonstrated expertise in historic resources. And so that is that's the hill that this applicant had to climb for obviously, we don't feel like they climbed it, and now they're even trying to back down it a little bit. But with that, I'm going to turn the floor over to Stephanie.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Stewart, and as Ty introduced, I'm the Land Use Chair with the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association. I've been working on this case rather intensely for the last 16 months. At 120 years and counting, Mount Tabor is unquestionably a testament to the kind of visionary planning many of us hope to leave as our legacy. And Mount Tabor preserves a captivating story of American ingenuity. Generations of Mount Tabor residents have worked to protect that story and this site on behalf of all Portlanders for all Portlanders to enjoy. Our legacy is clear. Today, you chart the course for the next 100 years for Mount Tabor. You hold in your hands the next generation's experience of this park. Will you keep this story and this park whole, or will you allow a giant hole to be left in it? We're asking you take the advice of the Historic Landmarks Commission, and that advice is to fill the reservoirs, preserve the structures, preserve the views, and preserve the park experience. It's the low-cost option for keeping this crown jewel of a park whole, and it also respects the history this site preserves.
My name is John Larson. I'm a longtime member of the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association Board. I've been before you before. I've owned and operated a graphic design business in Portland for 45 years. I worked with Portland Parks and Recreation as a member of the design team that created the Oregon Holocaust Memorial in Washington Park. I served as the typographer for the monuments at Director Park. I served as a member of the Citizens Advisory Committee for the Hawthorne Transportation Plan. I served in that capacity for so long, having been appointed by City Commissioner Earl Blumenauer, that when I retired, it was under the administration of Sam Adams. And I also served on the Nonconforming Sewer Committee that was established by Commissioner Saltzman. And so I've worked with Parks, and I've worked with BES, and I've worked with PBOT, and I have to say that I've worked happy and collaboratively with them, and I've just been completely confounded by the Water Bureau's approach to Mount Tabor. Here we are at odds for reasons that are genuinely mysterious to Portland citizens, not just in Mount Tabor citizens, but across the city. Our position that these historic structures should be preserved and that they should be kept filled with water is just common sense. How is it possible that the Bureau sees it so differently? I've spent a lot of time thinking about why the Water Bureau and the community are at loggerheads in this unfortunate way, which is costing so much time and energy and effort all the way around. The fundamental disconnect, if you'll pardon the pun, is that the Water Bureau sees the reservoirs in only the most strictly utilitarian terms, with little regard for their condition and appearance, as you've seen in these photographs, with little regard for their condition and appearance, while the rest of us, you see the reservoirs not simply as a utility, but as an integral part of the experience of a beautiful park, the crown jewel of Portland's east side, which is exactly what they were intended to be when the city fathers hired the Olmsted brothers to design Mount Tabor Park more than a century ago. The Water Bureau, though, looking at the reservoirs through its particular professional prism, does not see any value in taking care of the reservoirs as historic resources. The inescapable fact is that they are historic resources. They are listed on the National Historic Register, and moreover, they are historic reservoirs that are central fixtures of the park. The Water Bureau says in its appeal that it, quote, balances dual responsibilities at Mount Tabor, operating a safe, effective drinking water supply system and being a steward of the historic resources, unquote. The community knows, though, through years of sad experience, that the Bureau does not do a good job of balancing those two responsibilities. That is what the record shows, that is what these slides show, and that is why the Historic Landmarks Commissioners unanimously decided to mandate future behavior and management practices for the historic resources. The Bureau's existing management practices do not come close to meeting the approval criteria for historic resource review. I own a commercial building on Hawthorne Boulevard, and I know exactly how attractive a target for graffiti and for trash that those large concrete expanses will be if they are left empty for any length of time. There is every reason to believe that the cost of cleaning empty reservoirs may well exceed the cost of cleaning them if they are kept filled with water. In all likelihood, fill and preserve is not an expensive choice and is, in fact, the least cost option. The conditions imposed by the Historic Landmarks Commission are necessary to comply with the code. Those conditions also align with the desires of the community. And filling and preserving is the least cost option, so they also align with budgetary concerns in both the short and long run. For all these reasons, we respectfully ask you to deny the Water Bureau's appeal and to uphold and reinforce the decision of your Historic Landmarks Commission requiring that the reservoirs be filled and preserved. Thank you.
Thanks very much. When you come back on response later, you probably are already planning to do this, but I want to hear from you. The Water Bureau just made practicability arguments about both Condition B and Condition E.
Right.
I don't need to do it now, but when you come back.
This is the first time we've heard those arguments because they said it was 2 weeks.
We'll give you a little more time. That is about 10 minutes, but I'll give you a little more time to think about a response to that, but I'm being a little flippant. I'm serious. I want to hear your response to that practicability argument that it's going to take, as I understood their argument, it's going to take longer than 60 days to drain and refill given the capacity of the pipe and the regulatory restrictions. I want to hear your thoughts about that. And then that full compliance with Condition E would require removal of equipment or facilities that ultimately are necessary, if I can again paraphrase their argument. So I'll give them a chance to rearticulate that argument if I didn't get it right, but I'd like to hear, when you come back, your response to those counterclaims from them about these conditions.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor.
When you're referring to fill and preserve the reservoirs, you're not saying with drinking water.
No, we're saying keep non-potable water. And we understand this is not the venue. We, the Mount Tabor Neighborhood Association, understand that this is the land use hearing. We're not arguing that question here. We're trying to be very clear about that. We are saying, as appellants, we are saying please keep water in the reservoirs so they look the way they look. That is how the citizens of Portland expect them to look. And we are saying preserve the structures instead of allowing them to crumble into disuse. We're asking for that. We're asking for it not for our neighborhood per se, but for everyone in Portland and for the generations to come, as you can see in the photograph.
Mr. Wyman, you did invite a question.
Yes.
I don't want you to leave the table without a question. I don't want you to feel disrespected. Both sides have talked about least cost option or brought cost into the equation. Do you have anything you want to share with us about the role, the relative importance of cost as any part of our consideration in this proceeding?
Boy, Commissioner, let's just say I could consider that to be a leading question. The short answer is I candidly don't. And the analogy that I make is a developer coming to you or to one of the lower hearings bodies here and saying, gee, we would just love to comply with the criteria of that code, but it's just too darn expensive and we can't do it. That I've never heard that. The only way in which that argument is made and articulated by developers is through the Dolan proportionality analysis, which actually, somewhat ironically, and now I know that I am off answering your question, but the Dolan proportionality principle, which ironically the Water Bureau articulated, and so they're essentially saying that Condition E would effect a taking of their property by the city, which I'm pretty sure is a non-starter of an argument. So candidly, unless you can give me an example, I honestly don't see where that cost issue comes into play in these criteria, which I pointed out. I just see as absolutes and not that balancing. If it said to the extent feasible, preserve the resources, which is a very common term in land use codes. So I'm sorry, I went on a little bit. But.
No, I appreciate that. So what I take from that is that the question of whether the ultimate outcome provides a sticker shock to either ratepayers or taxpayers, in your view, is not relevant to the consideration of what needs to be done to preserve a historic resource.
That is correct.
Thank you.
Yeah, and you've got that in your brief here as well. Yeah, okay, thank you. Other questions?
Neither Commissioner Fish nor I declared an in as a ex parte contact are what's in the